Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this pair of half-hour segments is entitled Caution, Lone Nuts at Work. The title derives from a very obvious and yet equally sad aspect of American political intellectual culture, namely the, I was going to call it willingness, but really the compulsion on the part of American journalists, American institutions, and an awful lot of individuals to ascribe some of the broad-based operations of fascism, and in particular American fascism, to the work of lone nuts. This is something that we have seen invoked from the assassination of President Kennedy right on up through some of the recent Nazi outrages, such as the shooting at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, and also the recent escapades of Buford Furlow down in Los Angeles. He is the Aryan Nations operative who shot up a bunch of school kids at a Jewish community center and executed, murdered in cold blood, a Filipino-American postman. We're going to begin this pair of half-hour segments, again, Caution, Lone Nuts at Work, by taking a look at part of the legacy of a couple of alleged lone nuts who were operating at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. Those two young gentlemen named Harris and Claybold were the fellows who shot up Columbine High School. That's discussed, by the way, in For the Record segment 150. Columbine High School itself has a very interesting history, having been the focal point of a major controversy in the mid-1990s over the dismissal of a teacher for showing the Bernardo Bertolucci film 1900, which chronicles the rise of fascism in Italy. Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris were open admirers of Adolf Hitler, and they shot up the high school, their high school, Columbine High School, on Adolf Hitler's birthday, and yet there are indications that there were more than simply Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris involved. The indications are that they were involved with some sort of Nazi organization or had come under the Nazi sway, and yet we were told that it was just these two lone nuts who did the shooting at Columbine High School, because basically they had been playing too many computer games. Well, if that's the case, then how does one explain the following? This from the New York Times of Wednesday, August 18th of 1999. This is an AP story dateline, Littleton, Colorado, August 17th, and headlined, Swastika Graffiti Greets Students Going Back to Columbine High. It reads in part as follows. Students returning to Columbine High School on Monday for the first time since a shooting rampage in April left 15 people dead there were met by swastikas scratched on restroom walls and a brick wall outside the school. The two students responsible for the killings, Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris, had openly admired Adolf Hitler, and they opened fire on Hitler's birthday. School officials said today that they had removed the 4 1-inch Nazi symbols and would punish to the full extent of school policy the student or students who scrawled the graffiti. Tammy Theus, the mother of one of 15 black students at Columbine High, and other parents patrolling the school before the start of classes discovered the graffiti on Monday. They covered the symbols with duct tape until school officials could have them removed. Quote, "It's like they are laughing in our faces," unquote, Ms. Theus said. Parenthetically, I would add, think about they. Who is they? Skipping down. "We are taking this incident very seriously, and I am asking students to cooperate to find the person or persons responsible," unquote, the principal, Frank DeAngelis, said. And skipping down still further, students said Mr. Harris and Mr. Klebold had given the Nazi salute in bowling class when they threw strikes and often told racial jokes. The two also wore long black coats in school, and Mr. Harris wrote hate-filled messages on a website vowing death to all who had slighted them. I would note that both also had numerous brushes with the law, and yet the police tended to brush those off. I wonder whether perhaps the police in Littleton, Colorado, were also members of the same Nazi milieu, which apparently held sway over Harris and Klebold. Well, obviously, the question suggests itself. If Harris and Klebold were the two lone nuts who played too many computer games and who perpetrated the shootings for that reason, who painted or who carved the swastikas into the wall at Littleton High School? Harris and Klebold are dead. By the same token, the same question begs itself when reading the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday, September 5th. Of 1999. That first story, by the way, was from the New York Times of 8/18/99. This again from the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday, September 5th of 1999. In the National News in Brief section, we find the following. This is headlined, Littleton Area Schools Threats, and it reads in part, grappling with the aftermath of the April 20th massacre at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, education officials say 5 other high schools in the same district had received letters threatening violence in the past month. And with the largest charitable fund for victims of the school shootings closing this week, the families of some victims say they are dissatisfied with their shares. Well, that may be, but the same question begs itself, who is making the threats? Again, we're told it was just a couple of lone nut kids who had played too many computer games. Well, if so, who's carving the swastikas? Who's making the threats to other schools? And by the way, I would note that there were eyewitness accounts at the time of more than just those two shooters. I would note, too, that as I speak in on the evening of September 5th of 1999, the country's been treated to two more Nazi massacres. One, a fellow named Smith, who went off on July 4th weekend, and most recently, Buford Furrow, whom we're going to talk about in just a minute. And the response has been, again, lone nuts. The Smith guy was a lone nut, and Furrow is being hailed as a lone nut as well, someone with psychological problems. That reminds me of the original lone nut, who was Adolf Hitler. Hitler was often described as being a madman. Hitler wasn't a madman. He was a Nazi. Same thing with Furrow, same thing with Smith, same thing with those two little brats at Columbine High School and whoever they were working with, because it was obviously just more than those two kids. They're not nuts. They're Nazis, and that's important to understand, because they're part of a much larger and more powerful milieu, and yet whenever that milieu manifests itself in terms of the daily events that are encompassing our world, the mainstream press, as well as the so-called alternative media, and an awful lot of other people describe it to the workings of lone nuts. I would add this is a form of political chicanery and journalistic and intellectual chicanery that is well established in this country, and indeed the ascribing of the workings of fascism to the depredations of a low nut is something that we have been treated to ever since the assassination of President Kennedy. And in fact, in the course of the broadcast this evening, I'm going to point out areas of overlap between the workings of lone nuts such as, quote, Buford Furrow, the workings of, quote, lone nuts, unquote, such as Buford Furrow and the milieu he's part of, with the assassination of President Kennedy. One of the things that led many people to cover up the assassination of President Kennedy, who had known what had happened up to a point, was that there was an elaborate attempt, and we're going to cover that attempt in a minute, but there was an elaborate attempt to make the killing appear to be the work of communists, either the Soviet Union and or Castro's Cuba. In fact, the fascist elements that did this went to great lengths to set up that cover, and that in turn led a lot of people to cover up the killing because they were afraid that if, in fact, the public perceived that a popular president had been murdered by communism, that this would lead to a Third World War. Once again, the Oswald as low nut, alternating with Oswald as perhaps commie tool, is once again making news. When Boris Yeltsin met with Bill Clinton earlier this year, he gave him the KGB files on Lee Harvey Oswald, and the media, despite the fact that these files are certainly not pointing in the direction of the Soviets as the author of this killing, are once again being twisted to hint that perhaps the Soviets or communists were behind the assassination of President Kennedy, whereas in fact they were not. We're going to read now from the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, August 17th of 1999. This is an article by Michael Dorman, D-O-R-M-A-N. It's from Newsday, and it's headlined, Documents Link Russia to Oswald, subtitled Papers Revive Conspiracy Claims in JFK Death. Those conspiracy claims are the thoroughly discredited claims that communists were behind the killing. That is not in fact the case. This article reads as follows. Long secret documents, or reads in part as follows. Long secret documents recently handed to President Clinton by Russian President Boris Yeltsin raise new questions about possible special treatment that top Soviet officials accorded Lee Harvey Oswald on his arrival in Moscow 4 years before President John F. Kennedy's assassination. The documents immediately generated fresh conspiracy claims from assassination theorists. Within hours of Oswald's arrest as Kennedy's assassin in 1963, the documents revealed, the Soviet ambassador to Washington sent a top-secret coded message to the Kremlin reporting, quote, there is nothing that compromises us, unquote, in correspondence with Oswald and his wife. The ambassador said the Soviets might discuss this correspondence with U.S. authorities, quote, as a last resort, unquote, but there was no explanation of why the Soviets feared being compromised or why they would cooperate with the United States only as a last resort. Well, as anyone who studied the Kennedy assassination knows, there was an elaborate attempt to pin the killing on the Soviets. This is discussed in, among other programs, RFA programs 15 and 37, as well as For the Record segment 158, which we're going to refer to again later on in the discussion. Skipping down in the article, Some conspiracy theorists suggested there might have been a plot by the Soviets to use Oswald in killing Kennedy. The Warren Commission and other U.S. agencies that have investigated the assassination said they found no evidence of Soviet involvement. But they apparently did not have access to all the Russian documents given to Clinton. University of Maryland history professor John Newman, author of Oswald and the CIA, and a consultant on the assassination film JFK, called some of the Russian documents, quote, highly significant, unquote. Until now, he said, he and other conspiracy theorists could only speculate on Soviet conclusions, quote, now we know their conclusions, that a right-wing conspiracy was responsible for the assassination, that the U.S. government wanted to consign the case to oblivion, and that the plot was designed to make it look like Oswald was employed by the KGB, Newman said. John Newman's analysis here, by the way, is absolutely accurate, and as we're going to see, there are some connections between the milieu that ultimately spawned Buford Furrow, again a supposed lone nut who was married to Debbie Matthews, the widow of Order founder Robert Matthews, and who was a trusted Aryan Nations functionary. The milieu of Buford Furrow, in fact, intersects with the milieu that killed both Kennedys and Martin Luther King, and that milieu also went to considerable length to try to make the killing of Kennedy appear to be the work of communists, this leading liberals and others who might know the truth, to cover up the assassination for fear that it would lead to a Third World War. This past August, there was a shooting in Los Angeles, one of a number of recent outrages by Nazi elements. This, of course, was the shooting by Buford Furrow, a former Aryan Nations guard, and a fellow who for a time was married to Debbie Matthews, the widow of Robert Matthews, the founder of the order that murdered Alan Berg, and whose successor organization, Cause, appears to have been behind the killing of Nicole and Ron Goldman and the framing of O.J. Simpson, as discussed in the book Blood Oath by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers. The San Jose Mercury News of Saturday, August 14th of 1999 was among the newspapers that raised questions about Buford Furrow and where he got some of the money to do what he did. Now, Buford Furrow also has been made out to be a lone nut, and yet, as we know, he was a member of the Aryan Nations milieu. The question is, where did he get his funding? Because he had a lot of money and a great deal of, or a lot of money's worth of firearms when he performed his massacre down in Los Angeles. Again, the San Jose Mercury of Saturday, August 14th of 1999 has a couple of articles that touch on this, both under the banner headline of Tracing the Roots of L.A. Rampage. One of the articles is by Jeffrey Toomb, appropriate name, T-O-M-B, of the Mercury News staff. It's headlined, Unemployed Suspect Had Plenty of Cash and Expensive Guns, and subtitled, Furrow's Network Known to Have Funds. This article reads in part, Where did the money come from? Where did hate-killing suspect Buford O'Neill Furrow Jr., a man who quit his job in October and then spent 5 months institutionalized, get the thousands in cash he used this week to apparently fuel a shooting spree that took him from Tacoma, Washington, to Los Angeles, to Las Vegas? As they continue a probe that has already led to murder and hate crime charges against Furrow, law enforcement investigators are returning again and again to this question. The answer may determine whether he supported himself, perhaps with the proceeds of other crimes, or whether the white supremacist groups who fueled his hate also fueled his rampage. And the article points out, too, that the place where he lived was extremely poor. And an article that is side by side with that is called Hard Times, Remote Depressed Hometown, Fears for Its Reputation. It's by Tracy Kaplan of the Mercury News, and it reads in part as follows. The county was so economically depressed, this is the county where Furrow lived, that federal welfare-to-work requirements are waived because there were so few jobs. Furrow, a mechanic, was forced to commute about 50 miles south to get work. The question remains of where Buford Furrow got his funding, and I am obviously not in a position to answer that, but what is significant, and I think Jeffrey Toomb is to be congratulated for at least asking the question, is where the guy got his money, and indeed whether or not he got it from bank robberies or from other members of the white supremacist milieu. The fact of the matter is that Buford Furrow, like Harrison Klebold, like Lee Harvey Oswald, and like a whole lot of other people, is no lone nut. He's a Nazi, he's a fascist, and he's part of a milieu that is responsible for a whole lot of damage. In numerous articles about the workings of the Aryan nations in the wake of the shooting by Buford Furrow, there were references to the Order. That's the Nazi group that robbed banks and armored cars in the 1980s. Their best-known operation was the killing of Denver talk show host Alan Berg. In the Tracy Kaplan Mercury News article from 8/14/99 that I just read, it mentions Debbie Matthews. And speaking of Medlin Falls, Washington, quote, "It was here that Furrow made his home for a few years with area resident Debbie Matthews, the widow of a deceased neo-Nazi who was the founder of another racist group. And it is here that Matthews still lives on land marked by two Confederate flags that were flying at half-staff Friday. That Nazi group is the Order, and we're going to reprise some information that we've looked at in past broadcasts. We're going to take a look at a book called Unholy Alliance, authored by Peter Levenda, L-E-V-E-N-D-A. This book is subtitled A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult. It's published in softcover by the Avon Press and copyright 1995. And there's discussion in here of where the Order, that's the group that was founded by Robert Matthews, got some of its funding. Of the Order, Peter Levenda writes in Unholy Alliance, patterning itself on an identically named organization in the famous racist novel The Turner Diaries, the Order was also responsible for the largest armored car robbery in U.S. history. Taking place in Ukiah, California on July 18, 1984, exactly a month after the murder of Berg, the heist netted the Order a staggering $3.6 million. The Order's founder and leader, Bob Matthews, intended to use some of that money to purchase sophisticated laser weapons that would allow him to knock out the Los Angeles power grid. Once again, this was a plot element in the Turner Diaries. Eventually, the Order was routed and its members either killed in firefights or serving time in federal prisons, but not before some of the money they managed to steal wound up spread around in the coffers of various other right-wing hate groups. I would note that in the novel The Turner Diaries, two other things, the group The Order shoots down a civilian airliner with a shoulder-fired heat-seeking missile, and they also sabotage the L.A. power grid. I would note that not only the L.A. power grid, but the entire West Coast power grid went out in the summer of 1996, the same summer that TWA Flight 800 went down under as yet unsatisfactorily explained circumstances. I wonder whether perhaps the Turner Diaries was being played out in the downing of TWA Flight 800 as well. In Unholy Alliance, Peter Levenda mentions that one of the sources for the funding, the seed money for the Order, was apparently, quote, German families, unquote, in Latin America. Returning to Unholy Alliance, according to one informant who told the story to former Order member Thomas Martinez, the Order was receiving contributions from German, quote, families, unquote, living in South America. This German Nazi, South American Nazi, North American Nazi link is reinforced by stories that German neo-Nazi terrorist Manfred Rader, for instance, met with Dr. Mengele in Brazil as late as 1978, before coming to the States and meeting with American neo-Nazi groups. Rader was eventually convicted of the 1980 firebombing of a Vietnamese shelter in Hamburg, Germany, which killed two of the boat people. By the way, Rader was sponsored by, among others, the German Army, the Bundeswehr, and he lectured to the elite Bundeswehr Officers Academy in 1995. Now, note the allegation by Thomas Martinez here that the Order was financed by German, quote, families, unquote, in Latin America. A savvy and experienced listener will recognize that, indeed, those German families were in all likelihood the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, literally the economic component of a Third Reich gone underground that I've discussed in numerous broadcasts available from Spitfire. I would also point out that in addition to the book The Turner Diaries, the National Vanguard Books Publishers, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, also puts out a couple of other books. One is known as Hunter. It's about a Nazi assassin who goes around killing people of color and interracial couples in particular, and also a book that I've alluded to many times, the book Serpent's Walk by Randolph D. Calverhall. That book is about a takeover by the Nazis of the United States in the mid-21st century. That takeover is affected by the descendants of the SS who go underground, build up a flight capital organization, buy into the American opinion-forming media, infiltrate the army, and then take over the United States. As I've said before, I think just like the Turner Diaries, I think the book Serpent's Walk is actually a blueprint, a manifesto for what is actually going to happen, and not the mere novel it's purported to be. Turner Diaries, or rather The Serpent's Walk, is put out copyrighted 1991, put out by National Vanguard Books, and can be obtained from National Vanguard Books at P.O. Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, and an emphatic caveat about this book. This is a Nazi tract from the most virulent of the domestic Nazi organizations, and so all due caution should be exercised. In this book, there is an indication that, in fact, the Underground Reich and the Bormann Organization, which are fairly clearly portrayed in this book, are, in fact, in charge of many of the so-called neo-Nazi organizations that are operating around the world. Again, as I've stated, I think just like the Turner Diaries, I think Serpent's Walk is a blueprint for what these groups are going to do. In Serpent's Walk, we read, this is a conversation between a fellow named Wrench and a fellow named Lessing. Lessing asks, what about the neo-Nazis, the Missouri Seven, the gang who blew up the power station in Munich in 2040? Wrench waved a manicured hand. Quote, they're part of it. Every movement needs street troops. Our enemies are tough. We're tougher. Indicating again in this quote novel unquote that the Underground Reich and the Bormann Group ultimately is in control of many of the so-called neo-Nazi groups. That is a connection that should be borne in mind, and that is illustrated by the statements of Thomas Martinez, and that would also place the Underground Reich in charge of the order and in all likelihood its successor group, Cause. What we're going to do for the remainder of the broadcast is to take a look at the milieu of Buford Furrow, the milieu which spawned Buford Furrow, and we're going to take a look at the overlap between that milieu and the milieu which spawned Lee Harvey Oswald, who, perhaps with the exception of Hitler, is the prototypical lone nut that this society uses to explain broad-based fascist phenomena. We're going to take a look next at an article from the Los Angeles Times of Friday, August 13th of 1999. This is an article by Peter Y. Hong and Ken Ellingwood, and it's entitled A Trip to the Birthplace of Racist Ideologies. And this talks about some of the Los Angeles roots of the Aryan Nations milieu, of which Buford Furrow was a part. And we're going to take a look at the political heritage of Buford Furrow, again, far more than the lone nut we're told he was. And we're going to take a look, as I said, at the overlap between the milieu that spawned Buford Furrow and the milieu that spawned Lee Harvey Oswald. And we're going to take a look at connections between the milieu of Buford Furrow and the milieu that performed this country's political assassinations, namely of both Kennedy's and Martin Luther King. Skipping down in this LA Times article from the front page of 8/13/99, we read, at some point in the 1940s, Hollywood's, quote, Anglo-Saxon Christian congregation, unquote, found a new American pastor, Wesley Swift, S-W-I-F-T, a West Coast organizer for the anti-Semitic American populace Gerald L. K. Smith. Quote, all Jews must be destroyed, unquote, Swift wrote in the early 1950s. Two of Swift's early converts were retired U.S. Army Colonel William Potter Gale and Butler. The Butler is Richard Gernt Butler, the head of the Aryan Nations, for whom Buford Furrow worked. Continuing with the article, Gale, a guerrilla warfare expert in the South Pacific during World War II, was an early leader of the extremist Posse Comitatus, a precursor of the contemporary militia movement. And as I've said, what we're going to do next is to take a look at areas of overlap between the milieu that spawned Buford Furrow and the milieu that spawned Lee Harvey Oswald, and we're going to take a look at some of this overlapping milieu, and how they in turn were involved with the attempt to generate the myth of Lee Harvey Oswald as a communist, that in turn led to the cover-up of the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, the three names to remember here are Wesley Swift, S-W-I-F-T, William Potter Gale, and Gerald L. K. Smith. We're going to begin by taking a look at Gerald L. K. Smith. We looked at Gerald L. K. Smith in RFA programs 10 through 13 about the evolution of American fascism and the Aryan Nations. Gerald L. K. Smith was a prominent American fascist and worked with German intelligence in attempting to overthrow the United States government in the late 1930s and early 1940s. Gerald L. K. Smith, again a virulent anti-fascist, was also involved in attempting to pin the Kennedy assassination on international Jewry. That, by the way, is also a tack being taken by a contemporary fascist, a fellow named Michael Collins Piper, who works for the Liberty Lobby and is maintaining a similar tack on the Kennedy assassination in the late 1990s. We're going to turn now to the book The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell, certainly the longest and arguably the best book about the assassination of President Kennedy, and one, by the way, which points out that the Soviets had advanced knowledge of the attempt to plot to kill President Kennedy and tried to stop it, far from furthering the plot. In the passage, by the way, The Man Who Knew Too Much was published in both hard and soft cover by Carroll and Graf Publishers and copyright 1992. And in The Man Who Knew Too Much, we're going to take a look at attempts by Gerald L. K. Smith to pin the killing of President Kennedy on, quote, world Jewry, unquote. Remember the name Joseph Miltier, because we're going to come back to that later as well. Turning to The Man Who Knew Too Much, the reader may recall the tape-recorded statements by Joseph Miltier that a propaganda campaign would ensue from, quote, an international underground, unquote, seeking to prove, quote, that the Jews, the Zionist Jews, had murdered Kennedy, unquote. Joseph Miltier, by the way, an individual we looked at in RFA program number 8, as well as RFA programs 12 and 13, and also The Guns of November part 4. He was a prominent American fascist who was involved peripherally with the assassinations of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King, or at the very least had foreknowledge of both. Returning once again to The Man Who Knew Too Much, an examination of certain, quote, propaganda, unquote, that came out after the assassination points in precisely that direction. Here are excerpts from Gerald L.K. Smith's Christian Nationalist Crusade magazine from March of 1964. Now recall that Gerald L.K. Smith is the American fascist whose protege Wesley Swift was, and we're going to take a look at, we are looking, at the overlap between the milieu that spawned Oswald and the milieu that spawned Furrow. This again from the Christian Nationalist Crusade of Gerald L.K. Smith. When Oswald was arrested, why did he immediately ask for a certain Jewish lawyer, John Abt? He has been the legal defender of many communists and was associated closely with the Jew Lee Pressman, formerly attorney for the National Labor Relations Board. Why do the editorialists of Egypt and Middle Eastern papers insist that the assassination was a Zionist plot because President Kennedy recently made decisions which were favorable to the Arabs and very unfavorable to the Israelis? Why did a man who signed his name Bernard Weissman buy a paid ad in a Dallas paper challenging President Kennedy and bordering the ad with a wide black border similar to the border which surrounds death notices? Was the extreme right-wing contents of the ad designed to cast suspicion in the wrong direction? And in parentheses, Russell adds, as we have seen, Larry Schmidt, alleged to have been involved with Oswald, put Weissman up to signing the ad. And Schmidt was involved with the milieu of the MacArthur Group within the U.S. military, and his admirer was Joseph Goebbels, and he'd put together an organization from within the U.S. military stationed in Munich, Germany. That's discussed in For the Record segment 120, as well as in RFA program number 11. So note again, prominent American fascist Gerald L.K. Smith's attempts at painting the assassination of President Kennedy as a, quote, Zionist conspiracy, unquote. And we're going to take a look at Gerald L.K. Smith and his milieu and connections to other American political assassinations in the second half of this program. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.